Okay, Book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of the most difficult books in the Bible to understand. I think that is safe to say. And the book, though, has very important questions that every generation must face, including our generation. And one of those questions that is being asked more and more is life worth living? And that is the big question in the book of Ecclesiastes. To many people, unfortunately, the answer to that question is no, it is not worth living, and they cover up life's meaninglessness with drugs and alcohol and all kinds of things. And you read the book of Ecclesiastes and you discover that is as old as the time of Solomon, of people doing that. But the Bible has the answer to that question, and the answer is it is meaningful with the Lord. And Ecclesiastes takes us through the pitfalls of an unsuccessful search for the answer to that question. Is life worth living? It is contemporary. It's as contemporary as 2010 and as 2011 in a couple of weeks. However, Ecclesiastes is often misused by false teachers. It's a favorite book of atheists and agnostics. They love to quote a few verses from Ecclesiastes and say, "See, the Bible says that." But in doing that, they are completely missing the viewpoint of Ecclesiastes contrasted with God's viewpoint. I put a beginning quotation in your notes here by Ray Stedman in Adventuring Through the Bible. It, that is Ecclesiastes, draws its conclusion from appearances, from looking at the world from a human perspective. Every aspect of life that this book examines is seen as under the sun, that is, where human beings live. But God's perspective is much higher than ours. He can see the world from beyond the sun. Man views reality from a limited horizon-level perspective, exclusive of the divine revelation, and that is the viewpoint expressed throughout most of Ecclesiastes. And when he talks about that little phrase, under the sun, you're going to see why he uses that, because that is a common expression in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, to us, it's a strange name. Where does this name Ecclesiastes come from? What does it mean? Well, as you'll see in your notes, it is an anglicized anglicized version of the Greek rendering of the speaker's designation of himself. In other words, Ecclesiastes is written from the standpoint of a person who is speaking. And he calls himself, in most translations, it's translated the preacher. Well, the name Ecclesiastes comes from the Greek word in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. That is the name that this man calls himself. So it's from the Greek word, which you might say preacher. In Ecclesiastes, in that word Ecclesiastes, there is a Greek word that is almost completely in those letters that we speak of sometimes in church doctrine, called ecclesia or ecclesia. You may have heard that word in Bible teaching and doctrine teaching and so on. It's the Greek word for church. E, in this case, C-C-L-E-S-I-A, ecclesia or ecclesia. That word church, the word church taken from that word means a called out assembly. So when we speak of a church is a group of people who have been called out of this world, called out of sin. And this term Ecclesiastes is taken from this title, the preacher. What's the preacher doing? He is calling people out. He's calling people to come and go God's way, follow the Lord, and so on. So that's where the word comes from. I know it's a weird word in English, but it's because of the Greek word that was used here when it was translating the Hebrew Old Testament. So it's a Hebrew word translated into Greek that means one who calls or gathers an assembly, does the job that of this man that's called the preacher in the book. Now the author, the one who is speaking, who calls himself the preacher, he never identifies himself by name, but I think it's obvious it's Solomon. And we can come to that conclusion because he calls himself the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So what son of David was a known king in Jerusalem? The best choice is Solomon. He's also obviously in the book a very rich, prosperous person, and that fits Solomon as well. The key word in the book is vanity, although that depends on what translation you're using, but in most translations it's translated vanity. It's used 37 times in the book. Literally, the Hebrew word that's translated vanity here means vapor. And the idea of something being a vapor then carries the idea of something that is meaningless, empty, and futile. That's how the word is used in Ecclesiastes. A contemporary expression of it would be you're talking about something and you're trying to make a point and you say zilch, nada, you know? That's the idea of vanity here. Ecclesiastes begins with that word in chapter 1, verse 2, and it's used 35 times along the way in addition to the first one. Then it's used a 37th time at the end of the book in chapter 12, verse 8. Now, the theme of the book, I think, is put very well by the ESV Study Bible. The theme of Ecclesiastes is the necessity of fearing God in a fallen and therefore frequently confusing and frustrating world. And its purpose is to spare future generations the bitterness of learning through their own experience that life has no meaning apart from God. And of course, Christ is in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes portrays the emptiness of life without a relationship with the Lord. Only Jesus Christ offers abundant life. So Christ is the theme of Ecclesiastes, even though he's never mentioned or even prophesied, but from the standpoint is he is the answer to the questions that are raised by the book of Ecclesiastes. In John chapter 10, 9 and 10, I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. I put some reasons here that I thought were very good, reasons to study Ecclesiastes by Philip Graham Ryken. Dr. Ryken, until recently, was pastor of a key church on the East Coast, 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. It's been pastored by such men as Donald Gray Barnhouse and James Boyce, and after James Boyce went to be with the Lord, Philip Graham Ryken became the pastor and was doing a great job from everything I hear, and good commentaries have come out as a result of his messages that he's preached in that church. And then last spring, I guess it would have been, he was announced as being the new president of Wheaton College in Illinois. But anyway, in his commentary on Ecclesiastes, I thought he had these good reasons to study the book. Number one, it is honest about the troubles of life. It's good to read something that's honest about the troubles of life. Number two, to learn what will happen to us if we choose what the world tries to offer instead of what God has to give. So it's a good book to go over with youth who are wondering, well, you know, if the world is offering all of this, what will it be like if I take what the world is giving? Number three, it asks the biggest and hardest questions that people still have today. What is the meaning of life? Why am I so unhappy? Does God really care? Why is there so much suffering and injustice in the world? Is life really worth living? Number four, it will help us worship the one true God, because God is presented in the book of Ecclesiastes as the mighty creator and the sovereign one. And then number five, it teaches us how to live for God and not just for ourselves. Turning the page, we start with our outline that's going to take us through the book. The outline is by Warren Wiersbe, and Warren Wiersbe wrote a series of small paperback commentaries, very readable commentaries called the B series. This one for Ecclesiastes he called Be Satisfied. And he did one on each of the books of the Bible, and they're very good. Then after he finished it, they were put together in the Old Testament ones, or four hardback volumes in the Old Testament, putting together all the 39 paperback volumes, and that is called the Bible Exposition Commentary. And either way, I would recommend any of those B series books. But as I was looking through my library on Ecclesiastes and preparing this, I just became very, very impressed with his commentary on Ecclesiastes. And if you're wanting something that's very readable to help you through Ecclesiastes, I can't think of anything that would be better. So the single volume, and I checked on Amazon, it's still available. The single volume paperback is called Be Satisfied, or All Together in Hardback, the Bible Exposition Commentary. Well, we have number one, the problem declared. And that is, the problem is, life is not worth living from the standpoint of the world, the person without God. Life is not living. But Solomon wants us to consider, number one, the monotony of life. And that's chapter 1, verses 4 through 11. Let's read, though, the introduction to it, and then read on into that. Verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1, the words of the preacher, so this one who calls together the assembly of God's people, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, so Solomon. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. And you're used to, in the Bible, having a phrase, something like Lord of Lords, or King of Kings. And it's the kind of the idea, the Lord of all lords, the King of all kings. Well, he's saying, this is the vanity of all vanities. People are used to things that could be considered vanity, just not worth anything and empty and so on. He says, what you know, to a lot of people, life is the vanity of all vanities. And it's a vapor and it's meaningless. So vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So Solomon is saying, here's this person that pours out his whole life into this job on a factory line, or teaching in an elementary school, or selling insurance, or whatever. All of this work you do under the sun, when it comes to the end, what good did it do? It's a pessimistic viewpoint. And it's from the human viewpoint, from the human viewpoint, life seems futile, and it's easy to become pessimistic. But what a relief in the New Testament to hear the contrast to that, which, of course, is Christ when he says in John 10:10, I'm come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. And the book of Ecclesiastes is explaining the viewpoint from man under the sun that life is futile, preparing us to hear, but it doesn't have to be that way. And Solomon is going to conclude the book explaining it doesn't have to be that way. And then the New Testament puts it in all of its fullness that the answer is found in Christ. And then Paul can say in 1 Corinthians 15:58, therefore be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. You do not have to come to the end of your life and say all is vanity. Your life can be a whole lot different than that. But this is man's viewpoint, under the sun. There's that phrase, the last part of verse 3. It's going to pop up often in the book. We won't be reading the whole book tonight, so you won't see it all here tonight. But when you read through the book, you'll see that phrase pop up often. And it's describing the human viewpoint of life. Verse 4, a generation goes, and so here's this monotony of life. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. I mean, think about your family. Maybe you know who your ancestors were back to your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. And you know that they lived and they had at least one child and then they died and that child had at least one child and died and lived and died and lived and died. And Solomon is saying, you know, we see that all the time. But yet the earth remains, but people come and go. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises, day after day after day. The wind blows to the south, goes around to the north. He describes the currents of the air, which science concurs with, and says those currents haven't changed in all these generations. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. Verse 7, all streams run to the sea. All the rivers and streams keep on heading eventually down to one of the oceans. But the sea is not full. The whole marvel of evaporation, that there's always the same amount of water, the same percentage of water is in the ocean versus the same percentage of water that's up in the atmosphere is always the same. Now, the last few days, we thought that came a little unbalanced as we got so much down here, but the scientists will say it always stays the same. The sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness, and man cannot utter it. And here he comes to continue this thought. And so as you see in your notes, Solomon looked at the cycle of life under the sun and came to three bleak conclusions. First of all, as we read in verses 4 to 7, nothing has changed. And then secondly, nothing is new. And he's going to go into that in verses 8 through 11. Look at verse 9. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. That is man's viewpoint. Man's viewpoint is there's nothing new under the sun. That's not God's viewpoint. That's not the Bible's viewpoint. The Bible's viewpoint is, but God breaks through. Things do not always go the same. God is all powerful. And there are times where, we've got many examples in the Bible. You have the time where Joshua is fighting the battle, and he prays that the sun would stand still. And we read that God did that. Now, of course, we understand that literally the sun doesn't stand still, it's the earth that moves. But from the standpoint of standing there and seeing the day go by and it's getting nighttime and the sun has moved across, that didn't happen. God intervened. And the whole thing about rain and so on, Elijah prayed and there was a drought. Elijah prayed and it rained. God intervened. God intervenes today. And so the human viewpoint is everything goes on the same as if there is no God. God's viewpoint is so different that he does intervene. Then the third of these bleak conclusions, nothing is understood in verses 12 to 18. That brings him to this second part of the problem declared. The first was the monotony of life. Second, the vanity of wisdom in chapter 1, verses 12 to 18. Look in verse 17 of chapter 1. Verse 17. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. When Solomon is doing his research into all these scientific things, looking at it from man's point of view instead of God's revelation to understand, he just simply found an empty experience. And so he says, I applied my heart to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. Because he's looking at it from man's point of view. He's not coming at it from the standpoint of God's revelation and what God has to say. Verse 18, for in much wisdom is much vexation. In other words, the expected outcome of wisdom is success. And success should be bring happiness. But Solomon has said, you know, when people leave God out, and they're seeking after wisdom, and they're seeking after this and that, and they might even get success, but it just winds up in frustration. I mean, even a lot of rich, successful people have committed suicide and thought life wasn't worth living, exactly as he says here. That's the viewpoint of the person without God. He has said nothing about God, and God is not mentioned here because he's giving it strictly the viewpoint from man. Then we have number three in this problem declared, and that is the futility of wealth, chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. And, of course, Solomon had much experience with wealth, being one of the most wealthy people who ever lived on the planet. And he says, you know, just on its own, not taking the Lord into consideration, it is absolutely futile. Then number four, the certainty of death, chapter 2, verse 12 to 23. Now in verses 18 to 23, Solomon is then going to give three reasons why he was disgusted with wealth. First, you can't keep it. That's in verse 18. And you read that, and we can read it here, chapter 2, verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. He can't take it with him, so he has to leave it. It's kind of like a reminder of the story that Jesus told in Luke chapter 12, verses 13 to 21, the rich fool who was very successful, and he was a farmer, and he kept having better and better harvest, and he said, I'm just going to build bigger and bigger barns to hold all this, not even taking into account that God might intervene. And then one day God says, today your soul is required of me. You're going to die today. And he left it all behind. That's part of the Solomon's disgust with wealth. You can't keep it. Secondly, you can't protect it. In verses 19 to 20, it's going to talk about that. And then the third one is you can't enjoy it as you should in verses 21 to 23. So you can't keep it, you can't protect it, you can't enjoy it as you should. So this ends this section, and he has a conclusion. And the conclusion is enjoy life in chapter 2, verses 24 to 26. This is the first of six conclusions he's going to have in the book. Each one of them emphasizes the importance of accepting life as God's gift and enjoying it. Let's look at this, verse 24 through 26. He says there is, in verse 24, chapter 2, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. Now he finally mentions God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? He's getting to the bottom line that's going to be woven through this book. Under the sun, you're not going to have enjoyment from man's viewpoint. But when you take God into consideration, have him in your life, then that makes the difference. Verse 26, for to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. What a great promise in Scripture that the one who pleases God, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, the one who doesn't go God's way, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. Now that's a general statement. And we can all probably come up with times when it hasn't happened that way. When a rich person has accumulated a whole bunch of stuff and then something happens to him and it winds up in the hands of rich people. Of wicked people. But God says this does happen. And the prime example would be the Israelites when they left Egypt under Moses. And you remember after the plagues and so on, and Pharaoh says, I've had enough. Leave Egypt. Get out of here. And the Egyptians wound up giving to the Jewish people their jewelry, their money. They were so glad to get rid of them. Now, it was considered wages for all that they had done as slaves all those years. And in that sense, they were giving them what they would do. But the Bible describes it that they plundered Egypt. That all that wealth of Egypt, they just said, it's not worth it. And they gave it to the Jews. That would be an example of this verse being applied. So Solomon's arguments here, so his arguments are the monotony of life, the vanity of wisdom, the futility of wealth, the certainty of death. His arguments show that life is really not worth it, the appearance that life is really not worth living appears to be true if you're looking at life under the sun. But that's from the human viewpoint. When you bring God into the picture, everything changes. And that's what verses 24, 25, and 26 do. That brings us to the next division in the book, which is in chapters 3 to 10, the problem discussed. This problem of the meaningless of life is discussed. And he considers each one of the above arguments. So those four arguments he's going to bring up again and discuss them. First of all, he's going to discuss the monotony of life. Remember that first one, that everything just keeps going the way it always has gone. And he's going to give four factors God uses to keep our lives from becoming monotonous and meaningless. The first one is look up, and that's in chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. And the idea here is that God is in control. He's in control from before our birth to the very moment of our death. He's in control, accomplishing his purposes. And in 14 statements, Solomon affirmed that God is at work in our individual lives. All of these events come from God, and they are all good in their time. Happens to be maybe the most famous passage in the book of Ecclesiastes. I know you've all heard it many times. Maybe you've really never thought of it in its context. That here it is showing that God is at work in our individual lives. But let's read it beginning in verse 1. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill. Now that would not be committing murder. That would be in war or government, that kind of thing. And a time to heal. A time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones. See, Israel, the land of Israel, is just full of rocks. One of the rockiest places on earth you can go to. It's I don't know if you've ever driven out I-8 east of San Diego, but you go east of San Diego and I-8, it's in an area where beside the freeway, all the hills, you just see all these rocks. So much of Israel is like that. So they were used to the fact that they lived in this rocky land, and anytime they had to build or plant crops and so on, they had to deal with the rocks. And so he says there is a time to cast away stones, get them out of the way for the field, and a time to gather stones together. Because then they used rocks for building their buildings more than they used wood. And a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek, and a time to lose. A time to keep, and a time to cast away. That justifies garage sales. And verse 7, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, time to love, a time to hate. And of course, the Bible does talk about hating evil, a time to love, time to hate, time for war, time for peace. And I have to turn my page. That brings us to the end of verse 8. So interesting list there that we can all identify. And of course, it's been put to music that you don't hear it much anymore, but back in the 70s, remember, it was a popular folk song, time to do all these things. But then that brings us to Solomon turning the page, his second word from God to handle the monotonous of life, and that is look within. And here he's going to point out that man is very unique compared to the animals. And that is that man has eternity in his heart that links him to God. Look at chapter 3, verse 11. 3:11. God has made everything beautiful in its time. That's a famous statement from Ecclesiastes 2. And he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. He's put eternity into his heart. God has, of course, he made man in his image, and he made man with a soul, and he put within man something of eternity, something that tells man about God. Now, man in his depravity, according to Romans chapter 1, rejects it and turns away from it. And that's part of the judgment that comes to man, because man has done that. But man has that in his heart, if he will then follow through on that. Now, there was a missionary some years ago named Don Richardson, who had been a missionary in New Guinea, and he had an amazing experience in New Guinea. that prompted him to write a book called Peace Child. And it was a great selling Christian book back in the 70s, probably, maybe even the 60s. And Peace Child told the story of, he was working with this one particular tribe, and the tribe adjacent to them was a group of people that these two tribes just did not get along, and they were constantly battling each other. And they were in one of their wars, and then he observed of how that they got peace. There was a child that was taken and became the Peace Child. And it's a long story. I don't remember all the details, but you can look up that book. It's still available, Peace Child. It's a good book. But he discovered that there was something in this tribe's culture that was such a parallel with what God had done. Because as long as the Peace Child was living, there was peace between these two tribes. And if the Peace Child died, then those tribes went to war. And this Peace Child is the child of one of the warring chiefs. And so then Don Richardson saw a parallel with the gospel, how the Christ is God's Peace Child. And as long as Christ lives, we have peace with God. And that became a breakthrough to reach that tribe with the gospel. So after that experience, and after he wrote that book, he began to wonder if other heathen cultures had similar things in their culture, something in their culture that just amazingly gave a picture of spiritual things, of the gospel. And he began to do research. And he found it time after time after time. And he wrote a book about that, which is still available. I went on Amazon to make sure it's still available, and it is. And it's called Eternity in Their Hearts. And the title is taken from this verse. And the idea is that God has put in people eternity. And his point is, he's found, he's even put in cultures, the connection with the truth of God. That if they will see that, will help them to understand the gospel. And that whole concept comes from this verse. Well, Solomon is saying to look within, and then thirdly, to look ahead. And that's chapter 3, verses 15 to 22. That is, look ahead to the certainty of death. Life is not always just going to keep on as it always has. Death will come. So he says we need to keep that in mind. Look at chapter 3, verse 18. I said in my heart, with regard to the children of man, that God is testing them, that they may see that they themselves are but beasts. Testing them in the sense he's to reveal what man is really like. He's doing things so that they will see what they're really like, that when they leave God out of their life, they become like an animal. And verse 19, for what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beasts and is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. All is vanity takes us back to the fact this is from human viewpoint under the sun. Human viewpoint under the sun, there is no difference between animals and beasts. And verse 20, all go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return. All living beings, animals as well as man, will die and their bodies will return to dust. This is not speaking about the difference in eternity between heaven and hell, and the difference between an animal, which does not have a soul, and a human being, which does have a soul, and so on. But he's wanting us to realize that there will come a time where we will die. Things will not continue as they have. So look ahead. Number four, look around. That's in chapter 4, verse 1 to chapter 5, verse 9. That is, look around at the burdens of life. And Solomon looks around and observes four different places and watches several people go through a variety of experiences. And he found that no matter where you look, you see trials and problems and people who can use some encouragement. Boy, have I seen that this week. It just seems like so many things have come up this week of trials in people's lives, either people in our church or their family members and so on. And a number of those have gone out on the prayer chain and so on. And Solomon is saying, look around and you will see that. And he looks at four places. First of all, in the courtroom. That's in chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. And in the courtroom, he sees innocent people being oppressed. And he sees the victims weeping, but their tears do no good. Then in the marketplace, chapter 4, verses 4 to 8, Solomon is disappointed to see that the only reason people worked hard was to make more money than their neighbors, and it was greed. And then on the highway, in chapter 4, verses 9 to 12, and then in the palace, chapter 4, verses 13 to 16. Then he addresses that another one of those issues from chapter 1, not in the same order, jumps out of order here, but the futility of wealth. Chapter 5, verse 10 through chapter 6, verse 12. Number 1, he talks about employing wealth. Chapter 5, verses 10 through 17. And then enjoying wealth. Chapter 5, verse 18 through 6, 12. But again, under the sun, they do not provide satisfaction. That takes him to a third of those issues in chapter 1, and that is the vanity of wisdom. Now, Solomon had said in chapter 1, in verses 12 to 18, that wisdom didn't make life worth living. But then here, he takes a second look at it and he modifies his thinking. And he concluded that although wisdom can't explain all of life's mysteries, it can make at least three positive contributions to our lives. So here he has three positive contributions of wisdom to our life. Number one, wisdom can make life better. That's chapter 7, verses 1 to 10. Let's read part of that, chapter 7, verses 2 to 4. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. In this context of talking about what we can learn from wisdom, how wisdom, as we grow in wisdom, can make life better. He gives this example, and wisdom would say, you know, life isn't just all a party. And if you only go to parties, maybe you need once in a while to go to a funeral and see the reality of life. Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of faith, a face, the heart is made glad. You really don't have true, lasting, and deep joy until you've gone through some sorrow and some suffering. People who've never had sorrow and suffering don't necessarily experience deep joy. Verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. So he goes on with some sayings like this. Secondly, wisdom helps us see life clearly. That's in verses 11 to 18. And third, that should say wisdom instead of we. Wisdom helps us face life stronger in chapter 9, or verse 19 through chapter 8, verse 17. Then he comes to that fourth one from chapter 1, the certainty of death. chapter 1, verse 1 through 10:20. First, death is unavoidable, first 10 verses of chapter 9. Then life is unpredictable, chapter 9, verses 11 to 18. And then, beware of folly, chapter 10, verses 1 to 20. And before he concludes, Solomon thought it wise to remind his congregation once again of the importance of wisdom and the danger of following folly. And he points out that folly creates problems. So we want wisdom, but under the sun, everyone's chasing after folly. So Solomon reminds four different fools of the danger of folly. He reminds the foolish ruler in verses 4 to 7, the foolish workers in verses 8 through 11, and the foolish talkers in verses 12 to 15, and the foolish officers, verses 16 to 20. Then turning the page, this brings us to the conclusion of the book, and that is the problem decided. First of all, and that's in chapters 11 and 12, first of all, life is an adventure. Live by faith. That's chapter 11, verses 1 to 6. So he's coming to his conclusion, and his conclusion, of course, life is meaningless without God. But when you have God, that makes all the difference in the world, and that's why we need to live by faith. Secondly, life is a gift, and enjoy life now. Chapter 11, verse 7 through chapter 12, verse 8. Let's read chapter 12. It is one of the, I would say, one of the great chapters of the Old Testament. And just a great chapter to read and remember. You may not remember the rest of the chapters from Ecclesiastes, but remember chapter 12. Verse 1, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. So again, Ecclesiastes is a great book to go over with youth with. And the bottom line, after everything that he's talked about, going through riches and going through pleasure and trying all these things, and then he says, but here's the answer. Remember now your Creator. Turn to God in the days of your youth, before the evil days come. In other words, before the trials of life as we are an adult. And the years draw near of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Now there he's describing the last days of a person before they die. And, you know, the food doesn't taste good and so on. He says, before you get to that point, remember now your Creator. That's going to make all the difference when you do get to that point. Because I know I've seen, and I would imagine you have too, older people who are in that stage of life where they're infirm, they're bedridden, nothing tastes good and so on, and yet there's a joy, and it's because of their relationship with the Lord. That makes a difference. Verse 2, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. And here he begins to describe the body wearing out. In the day when the keepers of the house tremble. Keepers of the house probably is referring to the hands and the arms that protect the body. You know, we're about to fall and we put our out to break our fall, or something's about to hit our eyes and we put our hand up to keep it from hitting our eyes, that kind of thing. Keepers of the body. Keepers of the house. And these verses will certainly, I think, remind us of Stuart Hamlin's song, This Old House, and talking about the window panes are broken and the roof leaks and all those things, describing a person in the older years of their life. And the strong men are bent, that would be the legs, which once were very strong and straight and able to hold them up, and now they can't. The grinders cease because they are few. I think that's obvious, referring to the teeth, which, of course, in Solomon's day, they didn't have all the means of dental surgery and replacing teeth and so on. And they would become older and lose their teeth and have no replacements, and they couldn't chew their food anymore. And those who look through the windows are dimmed, the eyes, cataracts, and so on. And the doors on the streets are shut. That probably is referring to the lips. And the sound of the grinding is low. Their hearing is going bad. And one rises up at the sound of a bird. They sleep so lightly. And all the daughters of song are brought low. They can't hear the high-pitched voices. My dad's dad in Kansas had a hearing problem all of his life, and just got worse all of his life. And when I read that verse, I think of when we visited my grandparents when my sister was young. And my sister would try to talk to Grandpa, and he just couldn't hear, because the worst thing for him to hear were soft, high voices. And I remember Grandma just being irritated with him and saying, "Can't you hear your granddaughter?" Well, he couldn't hear his granddaughter. And that's what he's talking about here. And in verse 5, they are afraid of what is high. A person who in their youth may have had no problems with heights, but they get older and they have some fears, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms. The almond blossoms are white. So it's referring to the hair turning white. The grasshopper drags itself along. They can barely walk. And desire fails. The sexual desire wanes. Because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, be the spinal cord, that kind of thing, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern. All those last phrases refer to the circulatory system, the heart and the everything involving that. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. That's a great principle of God's work of making us, the fact that the spirit returns to God who gave it. We were given life by God. When I was in junior high, I was very active in our local junior high Youth for Christ Club, which met every week, and we would have usually a different pastor come each week, and it was evangelistic. It was for reaching unsaved students at the junior high school and so on. The one message I remember today from all those junior high YFC meetings was a pastor came and preached that passage. But with the emphasis, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. So life is a gift, enjoy it now. Then in verses 9 to 12, life is a school, learn your lessons. And he talks about that. But then lastly, life is a stewardship, fear God. Look at the end of the book, verse 13, chapter 12. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Instead of life under the sun, it's life under God. And put him first. Verse 14, for God will bring every deed into judgment and every secret thing, whether good or evil. He sees and he cares, of course, is the message of the Bible. Well, I put a concluding thought here by Warren Wiersbe. Life is filled with difficulties and perplexities. King Solomon concluded, and there's much that nobody can understand, let alone control. From the human point of view, it's all vanity and folly. But life is God's gift to us, and he wants us to enjoy it and use it for his glory. So instead of complaining about what you don't have, start giving thanks for what you do have and be satisfied, which was his title, Be Satisfied, for the original B book on Ecclesiastes. Well, I hope that gives you a better understanding of the book, because it is a challenge to read through if you're just coming with no comprehension that it's philosophical, talking about life under the sun in contrast to how life should be under God. Now, we won't meet next week, the week between Christmas and New Year's. We'll take a break. 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be back, and we come to one of the other most unique books in the Bible, and that is the Song of Solomon. I am really anxious to know what I'm going to say about Song of Solomon. And quite an interesting book to study. And it's going to be a challenge for me because, to be frank, because there are several different ways out there to look at Song of Solomon. And I want us to do the biblical way. And it's going to be challenging, but certainly a unique book in the Bible. Well, let's turn off the recording and have prayer requests.